Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. I do want to take a moment to give a shout out to Crystal Elkori, who was assisting me with the podcast from October to February, and she just did a phenomenal job, and I want to make sure to just say how much I adore and appreciate all of Crystal's hard work. She was transcribing episodes, she was doing all the social media, she gave the website a facelift, made the search function so much easier. Good gosh, she made it so much easier to find episodes. It was ridiculous, and I didn't even ask her to do that. So thank you so much, Crystal, and your impact is long-lasting. So welcome to our latest guest, Sonia Chung.
I'm delighted to be here.
Sonia is the author of the novels The Loved Ones and Long for This World. She's a staff writer for The Millions and founding editor of Bloom, which you may be very familiar with. And you're a writer in residence at Skidmore College as
That's
well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You've had a very multifaceted career. We were saying just before I hit the record button, it's like, so you're saying you do so much, and I'm like, good God, you do so much.
We all do, you know. We're all hustling, aren't we?
And you're two books in. That's really amazing.
Thank you.
That you finished two books.
No, I feel that way too, actually. After book two, for me, I really had a sense. Book one was really hard in its own way, mm-hmm. but it has kind of the energy of being book one, right? It's like your first try out and you're just figuring it out. You don't actually know what you've gotten into, so you're not quite as, I don't know, terrified of it in some ways. Book two was really hard, so it feels like something. It feels like, okay, because if you finish one book, you fear that maybe that, you know, was a fluke and you're not really a writer. You're an imposter. So yeah, I think post book two actually does feel like something.
That's so interesting, because I've been hearing this a lot, the term imposter syndrome.
Yeah, really?
I'm hearing this from people who get the book deal, and then the book publishes, and I guess, I don't know if anything really alleviates that. Mm-hmm. If you get worldwide acclaim, if you make the New York Times bestseller list, if you get all these book award nominations,
right.
Does that actually go away?
That's a good question. I mean, I would say imposter syndrome probably goes away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have the pleasure and privilege of being close to friends with writers much further along than I am. You know, bestsellers, big award winners, really well-known writers who still feel very insecure about, for instance, a bad review always hurts. It doesn't matter. You can be whoever. It always hurts. Rejection always hurts. A bad review always hurts. There's always that. But I would say that for me, after book two, I at least have a little bit of, just a little more of a, I guess, secure sense that indeed I am a writer.
Okay.
That's what I do. That's what I'm hopefully going to keep doing. The degree of success one has with that is a totally different question.
That's true. Yeah. And there was a 6-year gap. I was talking to Rahul Mehta a couple years ago, and he also had a several years gap between his debut book and his second book, and was very concerned about whether or not, A, his publisher was still going to publish the book, because they expected it so much sooner, and what the book was.
Yeah.
It's also hard, because once book one comes out, you're technically just publicity marketing city.
Yeah.
You're talking about this book constantly.
Yeah.
And in the midst, technically, I guess you're supposed to be writing the second one, right?
I like your air quotes there, yeah.
I do air quotes a lot.
Supposed to be writing that book, yeah.
Or thinking about it,
yeah.
You know, because people are always asking that question, right?
Yeah.
So what's next?
Yeah, exactly.
I liked your book. What's next?
Yeah. I think it's very individual, right? So I think, again, after book two, I have a better sense of sort of what my pacing is. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty slow. I think probably, I mean, I've taught full time and worn all these hats, and that's certainly part of what slows one down, is you're trying to make a living in other ways. But I actually think my process of writing a novel, I mean, I sort of think I'm a 6-year novelist. I think that I could win the lottery. I think it would probably take me that much time, or around that much time. And that, for me, that's just about how long it takes me to figure out what the book's about. I write a lot of pages that disappear and don't make it. Mm-hmm. The book starts out being about one thing and has to, it really has to, I have to wander kind of far afield to figure out what the thing
wow.
is. Yeah.
Okay. I feel similarly in mm-hmm. my process. And you have gorgeous, gorgeous covers.
Thanks. Thank you. There's stories behind those. But
good ones? I mean, yeah. I'm looking at the loved ones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the kind of quick summary is this is a novel about inheritance and loss. Mm-hmm. And it feels very literary to me. Mm-hmm. The title, The Loved Ones, can go any which way, right? Mm-hmm. It could be romance. It could be, you know, mm-hmm. you can go, just the title doesn't. But, you know, the fact that it's empty frames and very clean,
uh-huh.
I feel like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it hits that to me. Okay, empty frames, family, empty mm-hmm. frames, something's missing, something's uh-huh. being searched for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I kind of gather that
yeah.
from that immediacy.
Yeah.
So it intrigues me.
Good.
Enough.
I think that's what a book jacket should do. Be a little I like it cuz it's a little spooky with the empty empty frames, like that's a little spooky.
And it's you know, it's very kind of ornate
mm-hmm.
as well as so neat.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, the purposely dictating this for y'all. So it's like sky blue and then these white frames.
Uh-huh.
So it's very stark
yeah.
in that way.
Yeah. You know, I mean, so. I would say like my personality, my temperament felt like the loopiness of the font is sort of bold and loopy.
Yes. And it stands out very much.
It stands out a lot.
It's readable.
Yeah, yeah. So it didn't sort of fit my temperament. But then what was wonderful is when the book started making some of these lists, like top 20, top 10, mm-hmm. you know, and then on a screen, the book jackets are all sort of lined up in a, you know, in these grids,
yeah.
and you could see how much it sort of popped out, and that was like, oh, okay, yeah. now I see why that's helpful. I mean, that's the thing you're doing here on this podcast. It's where art and business are mm-hmm. trying to get along or trying to be synergistic, and it's a very complicated thing, but
it is.
We work at it. We have to work at it.
So how do you work it as writer and instructor?
As writer and instructor, that's an interesting question.
Because you're creating, but you're also trying to give elements of craft to people. And I don't know how much you talk about the business. I tend to ask authors a lot. I said, do you ever talk to people in the business?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of MFA candidates, they're coming out and they said, I don't know how to pitch. I don't know if you receive pitches as well.
Yeah,
they're like, this person doesn't know what a pitch is.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah, yeah. as far as how much I talk about the business as a teacher, I teach undergrad, so I don't mm-hmm. do it a lot. But in my advanced level class, I tend to devote one class at the end of the semester to talking about it. And my goal is, even when I do it at conferences and things with adult writers, my goal is always to kind of demystify it because mm-hmm. I don't think it's as mystifying as people fear it is. And I was very much a person, when I was starting to try to publish things, even though I had an MFA, I really had no idea what I was doing. I didn't have much of a community.
Were you in New York?
I was in New York at the time. But I was, partly because of what was going on in my personal life and partly just because of my introverted temperament, I wasn't like in the world. I didn't have writer friends. I didn't really, I didn't know anyone in publishing. So I just sort of like, I don't know what, like did some research on my own and followed some directions that I found. And from my experience, it can be figured out just as a person with some common sense and some human skills.
Thank you for saying
that. You know, like the people on the other side of whatever you're trying to sell or whatever, they're people. They're just mm-hmm. they're human beings who generally care about literature and love books and have good intentions. Mm-hmm. I want to be treated with respect. Yeah, so I mostly do kind of a demystifying thing about how to start, how to think about it. Mm-hmm. How to think about when you're ready even to start sending things out, that kind of thing.
So when you transitioned out of the nonprofit world, you started immersing yourself more in the writer world, so the community kind of came with it.
That's right.
So to speak.
Yeah.
And you also write for the millions.
Yeah, which
you've been there for since your first book came out.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Since just a little bit before that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a few things happened. I mean, man, it really changes quickly. I mean, on the one hand, it's funny because a lot of writers will say, when you publish your first book, you expect, like, the sky's going to fall. Like, your whole life is going to be different. And I think there are a lot of people who are disappointed by how not different it is, actually. Like, your book comes out, it has 2 or 3 weeks of media coverage, and then you have to go back to, you know, doing your laundry. But you're still the same person, yeah.
And hopefully you were doing it while the book was...
Exactly. You know, you're still going to walk the dog and pay the bills. But for me, everything really did change because I was so isolated and not inside of literary community. So you publish a book and you start getting invited to things and people, opportunities open up and you start to meet people and then you start teaching and meeting other writers who are also teaching. And so suddenly, it was like I walked into a room that I had never been in and there were all these other writers, which was great. And then two other things happened that also built that community for me was... writing for The Millions. And I should say that back then, even though The Millions was an early literary blog, they called it a blog back then.
Did they?
Oh yeah, it was sort of that single scroll format, you know, one at a time way back then.
I don't even remember these things.
Yeah, well, you're too young for that. Yeah, I mean, you're too young. You weren't, you know, a whole generation has sort of come and gone.
Well, I remember Netscape. That was horrible.
Netscape
was the worst. You look at everything now.
But yeah, I mean, someone told me, my publisher, who was also in this weird in-between stage of, like, social media was still
new. Sketchy. We weren't really using that.
Yeah, my publicist, I was at a major Big Six publisher. They didn't really know what to do with Facebook. They just said, maybe you should be on it.
Yeah, because it was very kind of unilateral. You couldn't do all these things now. It was literally, you were posting BuzzFeed quizzes on Facebook.
Yeah.
That's what was, and Twitter, no one used, like, it was me and food bloggers.
Right.
That was who was on Twitter.
And then suddenly all these other people come and you're like, what's going on?
Yeah.
It was such a happy space before.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. That's a huge, that's the biggest change of the last.
Yeah. Well, for us, the book publishers, it really kind of screwed us because Amazon gained even more power.
Through that. Yeah. Everything changed.
Yeah. So you were at The Millions at this kind of infancy stage where so many people are understanding how to utilize.
Exactly.
And there were more probably literary spaces in 2010 as well. I mean, we've seen how many fold in 2018?
Right. Yeah. But they were modest and they were very much about, they didn't really think of themselves as influential places. They thought of themselves as sort of little hideouts for people who loved books, you know, just come here and hang out. And I really loved that about The Millions when I first... Because I didn't know anything about any of this online community stuff. So when my publisher said, you should get online and do stuff, I was like, I just started wandering around, found myself at The Millions. I was like, I like this place. I like what these writers are writing about. And I just started being a reader. And I would comment, and I would read, and I would just sort of hang out. And then little by little, I thought, oh, I think I have an idea for something I might write. So I just wrote to the editor, and he wrote back. He said, yeah, let's try that. And I wrote something, and he liked it. And then I wrote something else. And, you know, sort of 3 or 4 pitches later, he said, why don't you come and be a staff writer? So that sort of, it happened in these very tiny little dipping my toe in kinds of ways. And then, you know, 2 or 3 years after I showed up there was when they sort of redid the whole thing. It became much bigger. I mean, these were the people who were with it sort of in my cohort. Garth Hallberg, Eden Lepicki, Emily St. John Mandel, myself, and a few other people who, you know, we were all just kind of like hanging out, writing our own first books. And those, you know, their careers really blew up in the years following. So that became a really important community because as a literary novelist, your readership, the sheer numbers are just not going to anywhere compare to something like The Millions. The Millions has, I want to say, like 60, 70,000 unique weekly readers.
Mm.
You're just not going to get that as a novelist. So,
very true.
Yeah. Yeah. So having that sort of place to write and also have community was really important. And then the other thing that happened was that because I was 37 when my first book came out, which did not, to me, feel old at all.
It's not.
However,
says the 38-year-old.
However, there was so much stuff about young writers awards, and they were often 35 and under.
Yes.
They were all 40 and under, and I knew that I wasn't going to finish another book before I was 40. So I knew my next book I was definitely going to no longer be young. And I was really frustrated by that. I felt like there was a lot of focus on young writers and precociousness and all that.
And it's kind of genius mentality, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow, you're a wunderkind.
Yeah.
If you finished how many books before you're 30?
Right. Also. And also just that rushed feeling, like we just said, like, I don't think 6 years is a long time to take to write a novel.
I don't think so.
But
either.
If something in the media culture is making you feel like, if I don't finish a novel in 3.5 years, there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. That was something I wanted to kind of battle. So I just started, for my own sanity, like listing all of the writers, living and dead, who had started publishing later, late 30s, 40s, older. And that list was so long, it was so clear to me that that was a distortion in the literary media.
Absolutely.
That was just not true, that the most exciting, best writers were fast and early. It just wasn't true.
Yes.
So I started writing a column for the millions called Post 40 Bloomers, because I didn't like the word late, because who's to say it's late? And then that turned into a separate site called Bloom. Mm-hmm. And that idea hit a nerve, because that community just started to swarm around it. And that became another great, important literary community place for me.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, too, because, as I said, I'm 38. I turned 38 2 months ago-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an Aquarius.
Yes.
And I did this whole thing of systematic milestones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to go to get my bachelor's. I'm going to get my master's. I'm going to get married. I'm going to finish my book.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll have kids.
Uh-huh.
Whatever. It'll happen. It'll happen as it's
supposed to happen. Air quotes.
In this time frame of, this is what you accomplish before you're 30, 35. And did all those things, got divorced.
Mm-hmm. You know? Ditto, divorcees club.
And haven't finished that project I started in my late 20s because it just wasn't the time.
Yep.
I was writing Dawson's Creek-esque stuff. No offense to people who like Dawson's Creek, but it was very kind of CW-esque.
In literary form or for TV? Actually, for TV.
No, a literary form.
Yeah.
And again, not to say there wasn't depth to Dawson's Creek. I loved Buffy.
Uh-huh.
I learned a lot from it. But it was kind of stagnant in the way that it was only looking at one thing. It was kind of, actually, I was very much immersed in the 90s. Reality Bites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That kind of singles.
You're a young Gen Xer is what you are. Yeah.
Yeah. I would like to think so. I don't know. I'm stuck in this Xennial.
Right.
Because I'm not quite a millennial, and I'm
right.
not quite. But, I was raised on, Ethan Hawke, Winona Ryder, all those people.
I watched the Before Sunset movies in real time at their age with us.
I remember the original Werewolf in London and the remake.
Were you sad that Luke Perry died? Are you in
there? Yeah. He's only 52.
I know.
He's 52. This makes no sense.
Yeah.
Dolores from the Cranberries died. It's like we're hitting an age where our legends are going. And they're not
old.
They're not 95.
Right. Yeah.
They're in their 60s or 50s and whatnot.
Right.
So coming of an age of, you assume you've accomplished things because, Prince accomplished so much.
Right.
Madonna accomplished so
right.
much. So I wonder if this is just so embedded in what we've been seeing, and maybe it became even more so in the 80s or the 70s, child actors being able to sustain themselves.
Yeah.
And, with writers, it's different.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily writing when you're 16
right.
or getting published when
right.
you're 16.
Right.
But you paid for that MFA. Why haven't you finished anything yet?
Which is why I tell people, don't ever pay for an MFA.
Well, I talked to James Han Mattson and Jenny Zhang, and they both were at Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And they both said it took them years to sell.
Yeah.
Their first books.
They had written them, but it took them a while to sell them.
Yeah. Well, just for James, he was writing another book that the agent wanted, mm-hmm. and it wasn't the right book for him.
Yeah.
And Jenny said, you know, my stuff is very kind of weird and quirky, yeah. and yeah. quotes, more quotes. And she said she just had a hard time finding someone who saw that vision.
Yeah.
So it seems as though, whether it's your process or whether there's these kind of stock gaps with publishing, mm-hmm. it's still yeah. not going to necessarily be this smooth,
no,
quick
it's not.
Process.
I mean, it rarely is. And if it is, that's great. But again, that's why I care about doing this sort of para-vocational thing of being at the Millions and doing Bloom and having... putting a different voice into the literary media, because I think that it's just distorted to think that it happens like that commonly, or that mm-hmm. it's supposed to happen like that. That's just, it's just untrue, and I think it's important for writers who it's a long haul. Look, it's hard, it's lonely, it's difficult, and you need as much tailwind as you can to keep going. And so as much as we can kind of feed each other truths about that, mm-hmm. that's how good work comes through. You know, how many people give up because of false messaging or whatever, because they just think, you know, they're failing, when in fact they're not failing, they're just doing the work. And that's kind of how hard it is, I think.
Yeah, it's not a linear process.
For sure, yeah. And I feel really, one of the things I wanted to make sure to talk about to some degree is just the kind of the indie movement, the small press mm-hmm. movement, independent booksellers. So for me personally, and it's different for every writer, the pace at which something is going to happen, I feel weirdly confident that the slow part is going to be my creation part. Like, I just, it's going to take me, the things that I want to write, which are relatively clear in my mind, they're going to take a while. Mm-hmm. they're going to require some evolution of sort of skill, talent, and kind of human maturity. That's just going to take a while, you know. But I'm really encouraged about publishing because, which, you know, not many people say that, but because of the independent press thing. I mean, there's so much exciting, creative, independent Absolutely. Press stuff going on. And I think part of maybe publishing, you know, a little bit later than I wasn't 27 or whatever, but is that I know myself a little bit better than I did mm-hmm. then. I know what success looks like for me. I know what matters to me. I know what I need to feel like the transition from my own work into the world. I know what I need that to look like for it to feel successful, which is very specific. It's not mm-hmm. canned. It's not one size fits all. And because of that, I feel excited, because I just feel weirdly confident, like I'll find it. Mm-hmm. Because it's not about trying to bang on the doors that a gazillion other people are, you know, the five publishers that a gazillion yes. other people are trying to... Mm-hmm. Like, that's actually not my definition of success or what I care about. So, so I'm encouraged about the fact that one can make art and get it into the world in the way that it should get there if you can get the right team of people around it and behind it.
You're coming off very zen
yeah.
about this. How did that happen?
Oh, well, I'll tell you exactly how it happened, which is that my first book was published by a big six publisher. Mm-hmm. And again, I knew nothing going into it. So I just trusted that the whole thing would go well. Or would go the way it's supposed to go. And it just, you know, without sounding kind of ungrateful or... just, it wasn't a great experience. It was what a lot of literary writers who aren't famous or the hot thing or whatever, top of the totem pole, experience with big publishers, mm-hmm. which is that their books just don't...
they don't kind of surface.
Yeah, they just, that, you know, the resources just get allocated in particular ways and everyone's doing their best, but it just... your book just sort of gets kind of lost. And that was difficult. And then my second book, I was so much more experienced in the literary world, having been in these various communities that I just described, the Millions and Bloom, and that I just had a clearer idea of how I wanted to be involved, how I didn't want to just defer to whatever powers in the publishing world that, you know, hand the book over and there it goes. And so my second book was published with a micro-publisher called Relegation Books, and it was collaborative, and it was fantastic. It was like night and day. It was such mm-hmm. a good experience. Yeah. It was successful, and I'm putting that in air quotes, you know, in every way that I wanted it.
Because you were happier yeah. with the process.
I was happier with the process. It also on those sort of just commercially it did better. Got much more
visibility.
Yeah. It opened up many more doors, you know, and they got royalty checks. I mean, it just, you know, everything, on every measure, actually, even ones that I wasn't expecting, it was just a better overall kind of career moving and sort of spiritually moving experience. So, so I do feel I feel optimistic and I feel grateful. And this is what I tell people the most when I talk about publishing students and when I speak at conferences, that one of the most important things is for you to learn enough to have a much more specific sense of your goals about success and not just imagine that somehow there are three ways to be successful as a writer, which is to be published by this person, covered in this publication, and I don't know what people think those things are, but it's really a shame, I think, when people don't investigate what's really happening in the literary world.
Also, that, like you said, it sounds like you also came in to know yourself a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think we do that regularly. Hopefully.
Right.
Hopefully.
That's right.
And I had a similar experience with the anthology, Big Five. Everyone was super impressed, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone's super impressed. Oh, my God. You're published with so-and-so.
Uh-huh.
And no marketing budget.
Yeah.
No plan for publicity.
Yeah.
No da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And all that extra work, it's it. When there's not that investment.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I at least knew that. Because I work in publishing.
You knew what to expect.
But I think about the people who don't know it.
Yeah.
Or the people who freak out because they still get a good amount of visibility and it's still not enough.
Yeah.
And I think about, well, what is going to be enough?
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to know on the front end, who do you want to read your book, right? I mean, there are certain books that people think everyone's going to want to read it. It's going to sell gazillions of copies and it's going to reach across all audiences. And that's, you know, that's wonderful when that happens, but there's also something to be said about thinking about just trying to get your book to the readers it needs to get to, right? So everyday people, I mean, there's something kind of wrong with the fact that I've been following you and Minorities and Publishing for a while. I'm not the most engaged person on social media, I'll admit that. But maybe I heard about the book once and maybe I thought about buying it, but it didn't really get to me. And then once I came to it, because I was listening to your podcast and sort of stalking you, and then I was like, why didn't I know, you know, this book is for me, it's for my teaching, it's for my own reading, it's for everything.
No plan.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, I think the smaller publishers are becoming much more nimble and smart about that, about how to figure out who are the readers for this book, try to get to them and have them, the concentric circles of viral, spread the word.
Yes, I agree. I feel as though, especially for certain literary works, and people are, I want more work by people of color and people in the LGBTQ, blah, 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 I want these more works. And it's just never going to be as immersive if all you're looking at is the New York Times, if all you're looking at is...
Oh my gosh,
Sorry to say Publishers Weekly, even. It's the hot ticket.
Yeah.
It's who has the idea to look at something differently
and
all that stuff. And if you're not reading those, then you're not going to hear
about
a lot of these books.
That's right. And people are passionate followers of those other outlets, and there's word that can be spread very fast and passionately, and
and you get inundated. That's the ticket. And I realized that I'm just a pain in the ass, and I kept saying, what are you doing? Who are you sending this to? Why would you send it to this person?
Or not this person.
And it just made no sense. And seeing that everyone goes to that holy grail constantly, that the holy grail shuts down after a while, unless there's someone, an intern or someone, it's like, hey, I like it.
I mean, I wouldn't have guessed this, but all my years doing fundraising and marketing for nonprofits really paid off for me as an author trying to sort of think about how to ask for things, basically. The way what you want to do when you're asking for things, whether you're trying to get published or you're trying to get your work covered by, you know, in fundraising, you're trying to ask people for money, you always want to kind of be engaged enough in the world where you're asking for things and just really know, again, like, it's just human beings doing their work and caring about what they care about, you want to ask for things that there's a good chance the person could say yes, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And it takes real engagement in those worlds that you're trying to kind of collaborate with mm-hmm. and do this work with to be able to recognize what's the thing to ask for that's actually could be mutually beneficial
yes.
and someone can say yes to, and it works, you know. For
yeah. I've seen that in pitches, too,
yeah.
where people seem to say, I want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
What do you plan on doing?
Yeah.
You tell me what you want to do, but
yeah.
you're not telling me what
you're
actually going to come to fruition
yeah.
if I read whatever it is
yeah.
you're telling me about.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had a really great piece in the Millions come out recently, mm-hmm. and that one looked at, you did really great parallels, and you did a really deep dive,
mm-hmm.
and you looked at the film Green Book, which a lot of us have feelings about. I have not
feelings
seen
Feelings in air quotes.
So you actually had to see Green Book.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And sorry.
Let me just say, I mean, in a way, I tweeted about this. I was like, when it won, and I'd already heard stuff about it, right? And I just,
uh-huh.
there's so many films I want to see, right? And I
yeah.
just thought, no, I got to go see this. I got to, as a person of color, now I feel like I got to go see this.
So you
because
saw
I gotta care about
after
it. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah, because I felt like now that this has happened, it felt like a burden on a person, you know, as a person who cares about film, as a person of color, I thought, well, now I got to spend time seeing this movie.
I'm sorry.
Resented it. But it is a thing, right? You
mm-hmm.
don't we often have to read books we don't want to read or
yeah.
movies we want to see because it's part of the conversation and we have to care. So
yeah. But you anyway. Came up and you juxtaposed it
yeah.
with the documentary period, which I also have not seen.
Yeah.
And I heard about it due to the Oscars, sadly.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard about it. And
yeah.
I thought that was just such a great comparison from a craft perspective. I mean, I guess we should kind of also summarize what the piece is about. But I also really want to talk to you about kind of that inspiration after you see it of taking something and crafting it into like a larger lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully people taking something earnest away from that
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, I mean, so after the Oscars, kind of sensing that there was stuff to talk about in terms of Green Book winning, the controversy around it, why it won, why films in a year when we had If Beale Street Could Talk, when we had Black Klansman. And then there was this moment, and I reference this in my piece at the Millions, at the Oscars, where the producer of Period, End of Sentence, which won for Best Short Documentary, which is a film about the taboos and health risks for women and girls in rural India around menstruation.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the producers gets up and she's a white woman, white American woman, who says something like, this film, you know, only happened because of the girls at the Oakwood School in Los Angeles who had a, you know, who had a mission, who had a vision. I'm paraphrasing, but so she was very enthusiastic, obviously, because they won, but I just had concerns and sort of flashbacks to the many, many documentaries that I've seen mm-hmm. about non-Western cultures and places and people made by white Westerners.
And had you seen Period before the Oscars?
No.
Okay.
But I immediately mm-hmm. went and streamed it. It was on Netflix, I think, right away. And then went and actually watched all of the nominees for Best Short Documentary because I thought, this is an interesting parallel. This is an interesting comparison to mm-hmm. make. And primarily because, let me just kind of back up a little bit and say that I feel like in the last couple of years since the election of Trump, to some degree out of exhaustion, but also admittedly just because of my actual immediate life context, I haven't spent a lot of energy kind of battling or fighting MAGA Trumpians or conservative Republicans, or I just feel like that battle, that conversation, it's not that I'm not in my own way trying to resist,
mm-hmm.
but just as far as direct confrontation or what I'm going to write about, in a way, I don't know. I don't even in some ways know how to engage that
mm-hmm.
problem, that conflict.
It's also a protective element, right? Because that can ratchet up.
Yeah.
You know, MAGA person is not necessarily one I think you can have
a calm conversation and end it with, let's agree to disagree.
Right. And even if you do, what have you gained other than both of you being exhausted by the conversation?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to quit the possibility of having those conversations. I just frankly have not figured out how to do it or how to spend my energy productively. So my immediate world, it tends to be, you know, artsy people who call themselves liberals one way or another. And so part of what I want to engage here with Green Book and film and all of this is actually that slightly more insidious, even more difficult, but in some ways more important issue problem of white liberals having blind spots and having just not even imagining that they could possibly need to do some interrogation about complicity with systemic racism. I work in academia, I hang around writers, and I feel like that, you know, the folks who were shocked when Trump was elected, I just think about that Saturday Night Live skit with Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock, and it's like, we weren't shocked. Welcome to our world. You know, I wasn't shocked at all. So that said, I felt like the Green Book issue is part of that, because Green Book is a film that I think a lot of white liberals like. A friend of mine who's in her 30s, white liberal progressive in her 30s, put it this way: it's a movie that a lot of our parents really like.
It really is driving Miss Daisy, not necessarily 2.0, but then it flips it, right? And someone I believe wrote about that, maybe for The Root or Blavity or something, where they said, oh, it's driving Miss Daisy, but it's flipped.
Sort of.
Yeah. So it's just our generation's version of it.
Right.
And it makes you feel better because the black person, quote unquote, is supposedly in power.
Right. Supposedly is exactly the right word.
Yeah.
That's the non-twist of it, which is that the word I use is protagonizing. You know, who makes the film? Who's the protagonist? Whose story is it? Who's the supporting role or the character who, quote unquote, just adds color, which is the thing that I think white writers, producers are now realizing, there isn't much of a market for all white casts anymore. I gotta have something in there. Yeah. So let's add some color. Let's cast some fantastic actors of color who give real gravitas to the roles, which they do. And yet still, Green Book is about a white character who has his journey through self- whatever.
Yeah. Well, you also touch upon the issue of it being the PR issue of it being a friendship movie.
Yeah.
And that's how it was marketed.
Yeah.
And you note that, no, it's not. And you go back into the power dynamics of what we think it is, but what it really is.
Yeah. If it was a film really about a quote unquote true friendship, there would be two protagonists. There would be co-protagonists. This is a film where the character played by Viggo Mortensen, who plays it, who I also love as an actor, he's the protagonist. It's his journey. It's his, you know, revelation that, oh my gosh, this African-American man who's very talented and very unique and very respected, when I take him into the Deep South, oh my gosh, he's treated like an N-word. He's brutalized. He's all like, oh my gosh, I have to rethink what that means. It's sort of his journey. And it's not a particularly radical journey, frankly. Yeah. You know, I mean, in the end, what does he do? He invites him over for Christmas dinner and doesn't, you know, tells his family not to use racial slurs. It's, you know, so it's not, in my opinion, really a story about a true friendship. The African-American character becomes very dependent on the white character.
Yeah.
And sort of he becomes grateful.
Yeah.
Right. The white character becomes enlightened. But again, it's sort of touted as a feel-good film about racial reconciliation, about hope.
Yeah.
About hope. So, and it won the Oscar. So.
That's still a bitter pill.
Yeah. As it has been several times.
Because it's been. Well, also, because I didn't see the film. But I did see that the after part, the press room, and I don't know if you saw it too, where the son of the character Tony is the Vigo's character. The son is like the screenwriter.
He's the screenwriter.
Yeah. And he admitted, because as you touch upon too, the family of Mahershala's character was just like, this is inaccurate. This is inaccurate. And he admitted, the screenwriter admitted, well, I didn't know they existed. And I'm going off what I think happened. He alluded to a friendship, but it really kind of unraveled the fact. It's like, oh my God, you made all this up.
Yeah.
Basically, you had one clear concept, which was my dad was a driver for this prestigious black man.
Yeah.
And that's all he had.
Yeah.
And then he just worked within that.
Yeah. Well, that's even more, I didn't see that, but that's actually even more disturbing, because it's one thing if you've researched the true story, and as a writer, as an artist, you make conscious decisions to veer from the facts, you know, artistic license. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. I would want to sort of protect that license. But that license needs to be thoughtful and deliberate, you know. Yeah. But it sounds like he didn't even...
No.
He was much more casual about it. He wasn't even aware that
he
was dealing with a person's real life.
No one who worked with this guy even attempted to get in touch with the black family.
Yeah.
So they all relied on the white perspective.
Right.
So heavily that they didn't even try to vet it via the black perspective.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that Octavia Spencer was a producer. I have feelings about that too. Because I feel differently with her because she was behind the scenes and actually helped like fund it.
Yeah.
Whereas Mahershala is an actor and, you know, it's like, I gotta eat.
Yeah.
To dismiss. I mean, he also apologized for it as well and said, wow, I didn't know this either. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have feelings about Octavia.
Yeah.
Being actually a proponent of getting this made and then being the face in a way.
Yeah. Her statement was about she felt that the character Mahershala played, Dr. Don Shirley, the pianist, was a character with agency.
I heard that recently with Taraji P. Henson and that new movie coming out.
A character with agency, which I haven't seen yet, hasn't come out yet. I'm not thrilled about the trailers, but... Again, I try to withhold judgment till I actually see a film.
No, you're a better person than this.
But so, I mean, I disagree with Octavia Spencer on that point. I don't think this character, I think that's what's sort of why we have to look really closely at it, because I think the Don Shirley character in the film has the kind of, the on paper... has sort of a complexity or a something to him. He is quote unquote, like you said, the character with more power. His level of success and education is higher than the white character, but I don't see the character as one with agency as it is written into the film. I think the character is dependent. Mm-hmm. I think the character is primarily on a journey of gratitude toward the white character, and I think the character is somewhat pathologized, which is also related to this omission of his family from the whole film.
Mm-hmm.
He's just this isolated, closeted, kind of type A anxious guy, you know, without any community, any connection to other people, really. But again, that's sort of why I wanted to look at it. And back to the thing about this new moment of white wokeness, right? That the film, it masquerades. And I know woke is kind of a passe word, and I'm not hip enough to know what the better word is right now. But
Me neither. I can go with what the kids' lingo is.
The kids. We talked about age. But yeah, I mean, it has the veneer of wokeness that I think is deceiving, which is back to period, end of sentence. That's what I was worried about in terms of who made the film, who are the main characters, whose point of view is it from? Is this a story about white people saving brown people?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a story about, who are the protagonists? And I think that with period, end of sentence, it does a better job. And I think it has a lot to do with, again, who's involved with the making. The director is an Iranian-American woman. There are Indian and Indian-American producers who I can't know for sure, but who I believe or I hope were in the room mm-hmm. when certain decisions about through whose gaze this film is being mm-hmm. made. And it seemed to be, to me, that the women in this Indian village, this rural Indian village, are the protagonists, are the main characters of this story. And I was glad to see that, because I mean, I watch a lot of documentaries, again, made by people who would call themselves progressives, interested in human rights, mm-hmm. But largely white Westerners. And I think that they too often still make the mistake of leaning toward white Western framing, mm-hmm. The protagonists being whatever white Western person has ventured into this brown or black mm-hmm. world
to either save
or illuminate or bring the story to the rest of the world.
And so this is 26 minutes, period, end of sentence?
About, yeah.
It's 26 minutes.
About right, yeah.
Okay. So it looks at what the kids at the teens mm-hmm. did to bring this machine mm-hmm. also to gain actual agency to the community in India.
Right.
So how much time do we actually spend as a as a viewer in India?
So all of the film is India.
Oh.
And very little of it. Actually, the girls do not appear in the film at all.
Oh, really?
And that was a decision made along the way, which is to say, originally, there was an idea that the film was going to be about the girls and their project.
Oh.
The American white mm-hmm. girls from the private school in Hollywood. And based on my research about the process, somewhere along the way, this comes from the director, Rekha Zedtabchi. I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. But in an interview, she said, originally there was an idea that the film would be about the girls mm-hmm. and their mission and their excitement. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere along the way, someone realized that this film needs to be about these women in these villages and how they get the machine, learn how to make sanitary pads, learn how to sell them, make money, change the whole conversation around menstruation and being able to manage that time of the month so that they can go to the temple and go to school and mm-hmm. not be sequestered during that time. So the film is really about them and about their process of empowerment, which I think is great.
Mm. Yeah. And you noted that too, also the director of the documentary saying that she became more worldly, because she's not Indian.
Right.
You mentioned she's mm-hmm. Iranian American.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. her being a woman of color, even recognizing her own kind of
that's right
elitism in yeah. ways.
Yeah. Which I really appreciated. And I personally sort of attribute that to her being a person of color, which is that I think she understands what it is to be on the outside of something, mm-hmm. has a natural ability and awareness of the fact that we all have blind spots, mm-hmm. and went into the project with a lot of humility and came out of it with a lot of humility. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that about her too, that she understands that a 26-minute film, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. it's going to do something, but it's, again, not going to save all of the women and girls of rural India. It's going to start a conversation about a larger, complicated issue. That's mm-hmm. what it's going to do. And I think she strikes me as understanding that. So
when you saw these two pieces, did you see a way to kind of sink this into the larger conversation pretty immediately? Or did you imagine that that might come to pass? Or you just kind of knew, I need to see Green Book and see, perhaps enter the conversation about what the issue is.
Yeah, I mean, good question. I guess I just had a gut feeling, just sort of based on what happened at the Oscars. It's funny how, mm-hmm. you know, you're sitting there watching something unfold in mass media. Mm-hmm. You know it's a thing that's getting a lot of attention. I just sort of followed my nose and went and watched all of them. I had a feeling where I would come down on Green Book as far as my assessment. I actually didn't know what I would find about period end of sentence.
Okay.
So it was an interesting exploration and journey, reading interviews, watching the film a few times, mm-hmm. looking into sort of who the producers were and who was involved in the making and, mm-hmm. and likely involved in the decision making. I also watched all of the short best short documentary nominees. There was another short film that I mention in the piece called Lifeboat that I didn't want to say too much about it because my article wasn't about it, but I think it's another example. The filmmaker is someone I didn't know of before, but he's a white man who has a long track record of making progressive human rights films. And so he's a veteran, he's very well respected, and yet still this film about refugees in boats mm-hmm. off the coast of Libya, it still had some of that white savior, you know, black and brown huddled masses kind of framing to it that I think is still prevalent and problematic. And mm-hmm. I was slightly dismayed, in some ways surprised, again, in 2019, that we're still mm-hmm. we're still seeing that. Mm.
So from a craft perspective, because I think this is also a great essay or like interrogative piece to look at the way we're building it, what do you think or hope that also writers take into account? Because the visuals are so important for our craft, too.
Right.
Like, how are we presenting something, especially characters.
Right. In this piece, I start out talking a little bit about the Lionel Shriver dust-up from a few years ago.
Good old Lionel, who will probably say another think piece in another 2 months. That's something that pisses her off.
Are we still calling it Shrivergate? I guess we're talking about cultural appropriation, the question of, in literature, you know, who has the right, quote-unquote, to mm-hmm. tell stories about people of color. If white writers are writing stories about people of color, what does that mean? And mm-hmm. so craft-wise, I keep coming back to two things that are, I guess they're inseparable from craft, but they also just have to do with kind of moral centeredness of the artist. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Chimamanda Adichie wrote about this in an interview, or spoke about it in an interview. She talks about motive. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a white writer and you're writing primary characters or secondary characters of color, or you're setting your story in a non-white world or place, why are you doing that? I think mm-hmm. it's a totally important, valid question. Why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. What is the inner imperative of that story for you? Mm-hmm. Is it because you feel some kind of guilt or obligation in a savior sort of way? Is it because you feel it's more marketable? Mm-hmm. Is it because there's an actual connection and substantive something mm-hmm. for why you want to write that story? I think that's an important question that will show in your craft ultimately.
Yeah.
And then the second thing was just something that the writer Danielle Evans tweeted about mm-hmm. in the aftermath of Shrivergate. She just said simply, like, white people. who are the people of color in your life? Yeah. What is the nature of those actual relationships?
Yeah.
If you don't have any, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. think twice about what you're doing when you're writing that.
Yeah.
And if you do, it's, you know, it's worth mining the content, the substance, the truth of those relationships for what, again, what that motive is, or what it is what stakes you have in writing mm-hmm. those stories. Mm-hmm. So,
I don't know if you ever saw this meme, a friend of mine, Dennis, they shared it, and it said basically white people, if you know black people or people of color and they never talk to you about racism, then you don't have friends with
uh-huh.
people of color.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, somebody I know who would consider herself, you know, an intellectual, a progressive, all those things, said to me, The black people I know don't consider race their primary identity identifiers. And I said, well, I thought to myself, well, not with you, they don't. I mean, you know, it's that. It's exactly that.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
So thank you so much, Sonia. This has been, I feel like I found a kindred spirit, because it's like, screw this under 40, under 35 crap.
Indeed.
Don't need to write fast, whatever that means.
That's right.
And character. Character is everything.
Yes, absolutely.
All about it.
You know, I should say that my best friend in the second grade was Jennifer Baker.
So she
was white Jennifer Baker, but she was still Jennifer Baker.
There was a lot of white Jennifers.
So we were kindred to start somehow. There was something going on here.
You know what's funny? I honestly haven't met too many Jennifers I like. Jennies, yes. Jennies and Jens, yet, but not Jennifer.
Actual
for
Jennifers.
Some reason, I don't get along. So when I meet a Jennifer, I'm like,
nice to meet
you. Oh, God, this is probably doomed.
Don't kill off each other.
So people don't get along with Geminis.
Jennifers.
So can you relay for people how they get in touch with you? How may they read more of your work?
Sure. So
especially the loved ones.
Yeah, please.
Gorgeous cover.
Go to, my website is soniachung.com, Sonia with a Y. You can find me at The Millions. If you just go to The Millions, you can actually go to the About page and just click on my name, and then all of the stuff that I've ever written there will come up. And again, I'm a big... You know, it's always a thing about Amazon and indies, but I'm a big indie supporter. So if you want to buy my books, do go to IndieBound or your local bookstore. You can go right to Relegation Books. You can buy it directly from them as well.
And your first book was with Scribner.
First book was with Scribner. Yep. Long for This World. I'm very proud of that book as well. So if you want to dig that up, that would be great too.
Yay.
Yeah.
Put it on your syllabi, request it from your library.
I will travel. I love talking to students. So
do you do workshops outside of Skidmore at all?
I just started teaching a little bit at Warren Wilson, which is a low res program. Okay. I've been invited to do talks and things at, I did Muse in Marketplace 1 year, which was great. And I talked about this, different ways of publishing.
Okay.
Okay,
so not necessarily for like Catapult or Sactory
now,
because you got like the full time.
Yeah, I got enough teaching going
on. And you got your own writing to do.
I got my own writing to do. Novel number 3.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be
You're
great.
On track.
It's going to take 6, it's going to take 6 years.
So you're on track.
Don't hold your breath.
And also, are you on any social media? You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at Chung Sonia. I'm on Instagram.
Or is it? It's just one word.
It's just one word.
Okay.
I'm on Instagram. Sonia _ Chung. That's what it is. Yeah.
So I heartily suggest everyone follow Sonia. I really appreciate this conversation.
Oh, thanks.
This has been so delightful.
Me too. I'm really honored to be here. You are doing the work, Jennifer Baker. So I feel very privileged to have been invited to do this.
Thank you.
In very good company.
For your time this weekend.
My pleasure.
And thank y'all for listening. Once again, you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and at minoritiesinpub. And you can also sign up for the newsletter at the pinned tweet on Twitter. Podcast is on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn, Google Play. And I always, it's just kind of like automated that I need to remember all of these because I forget one. But it's everywhere, so there's really no excuse at this point. So thanks again.